Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to the first episode of Season 7 of our podcast, Archive Fever. Once again, in each episode, we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kinds of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
For this launch episode, we're absolutely over the moon to be welcoming a leviathan of an historian and podcaster to the humble room that is Archives Anonymous. It gives me great pleasure to introduce you to William Dalrymple, a man who wears many hats and I can assure you looks very dashing in a salwar kameez. William is an award-winning historian and art curator, a seasoned broadcaster and literary critic. He's written 12 books, all of them prize winners, and has been translated into over 40 languages. He's written and presented several television and radio history programs for the BBC, with his Indian Journeys documentary series winning a BAFTA in 2002. He's a regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Review of Books, and The New Statesman, and a peripatetic visiting fellow at the world's most revered universities, including Princeton and Brown. And he's amassed more honorary doctorates than Britain once accrued Brexit extensions, which is saying something. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh and the Royal Asiatic Society. And in 2018, William was awarded the President's Medal of the British Academy for his literary achievements and for co-founding Jaipur Literature Festival, which celebrated its 20th birthday last year. He was appointed Commander of the Order of the British Empire, that's a CBE in acronymic terms, in 2023 for his services to literature and the arts. And of course, in 2022, William launched the Empire podcast with co-host Anita Anand, focusing on the exploits of the British Empire. And subsequent seasons have explored the Russian and Ottoman empires, and Rahul Dravid, the coach of the Indian national cricket team, is apparently a huge fan of the podcast and has made the team listen to it. Something I'm sure the Australian cricket team is planning on doing with Archive Fever before this summer's Ashes tour begins. So you'll see that William floats breezily between the academy and popular culture, writing and broadcasting for a wide general audience and winning the esteem of dons. And we're absolutely thrilled to welcome you to the Archive Fever pod today, William.
I am very pleased to be here, Claire. Thank you.
So we haven't amassed the 88 million downloads for our podcast that you have for Empire, but we like to think we've done a...
It's on its way.
We like to think we've contributed something to the podcasting landscape, and terrific to have you here to launch Season 7. So let's...
If I'm sounding a bit muted, you, Claire, will know the reason, having had a very heavy night out with lots of sake last night in Melbourne. So I apologise in advance if I sound a bit raspy and headachy.
I did have the great pleasure of interviewing you in front of 2,300 people at Hamer Hall in Melbourne last night to rapturous applause. But let's take the timeline back further than last night. Let's look go to your early years. You've described your early life growing up in rural Scotland as like living in a bubble. Was it inside this idyllic daydream of a childhood that you were first bitten by the research bug? Tell us about young Willie.
Research would be putting it strongly, but yeah, I have always been fascinated by history from very early on. From I think when I was about 5 or 6, was going and haunting the Royal Museum in Chamber Street in Edinburgh, and going to their dusty top galleries, which seemed to be uninhabited and empty, where there was what I suppose by international standards a kind of second division Egyptian collection. But for me, at a time when Tutankhamun was arriving in England, and it was very much something that was on the national conversation, it was thrilling to just see these little bits of clay pots or broken mummies and sort of dusty glass cabinets full of pharaonic paraphernalia and canopic jars and all that sort of stuff. And then in my early teens, found that there was nothing nicer to do in your summer holidays than go off and dig on archaeological sites. So from the age of 14, I think, onwards, I could be found every summer with a trowel in my hand in some trench somewhere, excavating a broch, which is a Scottish sort of early prehistoric fortress, or extraordinary site in England called Hambledon Hill, which was an open-air exhumation place for all the corpses of southern Britain, apparently, where there were tens of thousands of bodies laid out, like in Tibet, for sky burials, in this extraordinary and rather eerie site on a chalk hill. It would have been completely white at the time. Then a Viking charnel house in the Vicar's Garden in Repton in Derbyshire. And my first planned trip abroad was to dig in Assyrian sites in Iraq. And I never got there because Saddam Hussein closed down the British School of Archaeology, and I ended up jumping on a plane with my mate to India, where I've remained ever since.
We'll get to India in a minute, but I want to keep you with the feeling in the charnel house and
we like a good charnel here in La Trobe.
If I can, and with those fragments of pots, and I believe also that you had a nanny who was very important to your early association with just knowledge and literature and politics and history in particular. I want to know what being bitten by the archive bug feels like for you. When you are in the archives, when you're in that process, how do you feel in your body about it?
I loved those. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever really been away with a bunch of other sort of, you know, young people. I mean, I remember my first one was in Orkney, and the thrill of getting the train up to the very far north coast of Scotland, then a ferry over to Orkney, arriving in summer. It doesn't get dark there. It's light all night. It's like being in Scandinavia or something. And arriving, I suppose, at 11 p.m. to find it's still bright light in Stromness. And then going out each day and digging on this extraordinary broch site. And as sometimes happens, you know, you make your greatest extraordinary discovery week one. I was happened to be given the bottom of this broch, which is kind of like a sort of dry stone wall cooling tower. And I've been just told to sort of clean up the floor of it and get all the dust out of the crap out of the cracks and prepare it for photography. And at one point, my trowel went through the flagstones. There was something, it was hollow beneath. So we pulled up, and there was this, what's called a souterrain in Scotland, which is an underground passage. And of course, idiotically, we went straight down into it. And, you know, God knows what we destroyed in that first minute of excitement. There was a little flight of steps down from this floor. People don't know whether souterrains were storage places or sort of residential or what really their purposes are, still a great debate. But anyway, there was this underground passage, which, you know, you can't ask for more than that. And then subsequently, someone found a penannular brooch, which is just this beautiful Pictish brooch with a side clip, which you'd keep your cloak fastened with. I mean, it was proper buried treasure stuff. So yeah, that bug bit me. I don't think quite so exciting ever again in all the many other summers I spent. But
you've always been chasing that first hit.
And weirdly enough, when I was doing the Viking charnel house in Repton, I did discover something that none of us at the time knew it was of any great importance. Among the many bones of what had been an elite sort of Viking special forces unit, some of whose members had been obviously killed by the Anglo-Saxons as they took the Mercian capital of Repton. In 860, the great Viking armies. I don't know if you watched any of those Netflix series that deals with this sort of stuff, like Vikings, or it's very much that material. Among the many bones were fragments of weaponry, and then there was one tiny bead, which I dug up, and I can't remember doing it, to be honest, but we just put it in a plastic bag and put it in, labeled it bead. That was it. Wind forward 20 years, a brilliant Viking archaeologist called Kat Jarman, who's of Danish extraction, is doing her PhD on this material and digs out this shoebox full of all this nonsense we pulled out of the ground, lands on this bead, and somehow realizes that it's actually garnet from India, and writes an entire book about this bead, which is a tiny little thing that was originally strung around some string or a bit of leather or something. And it reveals this extraordinary trade route from India to Baghdad, from Baghdad through the Vikings around the back of Russia up to Sweden, and then on the neck, presumably, of some invading Viking into the English Midlands. That was an earlier phase of my life. And I suppose most of my adult life has been spent in the more conventional kind of archive that that people would normally use the term for, which is a library full of old letters and diaries.
And yet, William, you're describing these extraordinary kind of Indiana Jones moments, but you didn't go down the archaeological route. You became an historian. But you've retained that love and focus of objects as part of your archive, part of what you, yeah, use as the skeleton.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the book Anarchy, you talk about the word loot. Tell us about the origins of the word loot and why loot itself has been so important to the research that you did for that book and indeed for the whole company Quartet.
Well, loot is an import into the English language from, well, what used to be called in pre-partition India, Hindustani. In other words, North Indian Urdu. And lootna is a verb, to plunder. And there are ancient words that enter the English language from India, such as ginger, which is actually a Tamil word. But the first word that the English Oxford English Dictionary thinks entered the English language during the 18th century, during the period of British colonialism, was, appropriately enough, loot. And it's used to describe the loot that English East India Company officers and soldiers and civil servants would bring back from them to the English countryside when they returned home with their winnings, which were often substantial. And India at that point was the Silicon Valley, the richest country in the world. 40% of the world's GDP was being manufactured in Mughal India. That wealth was transferred in a matter of, well, a great deal of it was transferred in the first 50 years after the Battle of Plassey, when the British go on this spectacular looting spree. And I opened my book, The Anarchy, with a description of these private rooms in Powers Castle, which is a private house in the Anglo-Welsh countryside on the border, into which family the daughter of Lord Clive, the Voldemort, really, of my book, The Anarchy, who's this extraordinary English guy who is sort of manic, depressive, ultimately commits suicide, but has this ability to terrorize and surprise and defeat his enemies, size them up. And he's the guy that really establishes the East India Company as a territorial power in North India. And he brings back the biggest pile of loot, which is still sitting, a lot of it, in Powers Castle to this day. The family, in fact, have sort of slightly taken fright since it ended up on the first page of my book and begun selling off quite a lot of it. It's now, I think quite a lot of it's now in Qatar before they get forced to send it back to India. They thought to sell it. So there's rather less loot now in Powers than there was when I wrote the book. But it is very typical of this period. And in general, when you go to England, and if you are historically minded, you might, you know, decide to go and visit one of those nice National Trust houses that has a lake in front of it that looks as if Colin Firth is about to sort of splash out in his breeches and rescue some lady in a bonnet or whatever. So those sort of houses, those Palladian houses with those lovely pediments, which were built in England between about 1760 and 1800, the chances are that if it's in the east side of the country, that is money that arrived from the East India Company. And if it's in the west half of the country, in places like Bristol or Liverpool or Glasgow, it's to do with slave money and the Caribbean plantations. And that is literally the division. Those are the two sources of wealth that had enormous quantities of gold pouring into what had previously been a middle-ranking European country. When the East India Company is founded, Britain is way below Portugal and Spain, which is flooded with gold from the New World, but also below France and Italy, which are the great mercantile powers of the Mediterranean. And by the time the East India Company ends up partly under government ownership in the 1780s, Britain is already at the top rank of European wealth and will remain there for a century until Germany and the United States start snapping at its heels.
What I think is so fascinating about that story and about the way that you use loot as a kind of organizing principle for your research in The Anarchy is that there's almost an artificial division between the loot that remains in private houses and private ownership and the loot that ends up in the British Museum or in other public areas. So there's a kind of methodological and possibly ethical point about who has access to those objects of the past. So you, as a maybe more, you know, more of a privileged researcher, might be able to go into some of those private holdings, but the public can't. How have you negotiated that sort of split between private and public access to these archival objects, which you can read as documents?
Well, because the law in Britain means you get enormous tax breaks if you've got an enormous house and you open it to the public, at least for a few days a year. Most of these houses are, in fact, open to the public. And Powys is a National Trust property now, although the family still lives in three quarters of the house, a quarter of it's open to the public, including these, what you call in India, khazana, treasury. So you can go around and look at this stuff. And it remains true that a lot of the loot, plus a lot of the archives, are still in houses like that across the country, because most of the people who went to India and didn't die in the first couple of years, because famously two monsoons was the average life expectancy of a Brit in India in the 18th century. But if they survived those bugs and the all the things that could hit you in that first couple of years when you didn't have the antibodies, the chances are that you could easily come out as a winner in that lottery and emerge home 10, 15 years later. Most of these kids went out age 16. You couldn't join the East India Company after 16, bizarrely. So these kids are going out, you know, when they'll probably not be served a drink in a bar in Melbourne. They were out in India with a whole fleet of native servants, punkawallas and all the rest of it, learning accountancy, learning the techniques of East India Company extraction. And if all went well and they didn't die, they would hope to be back by their mid-30s. And then the classic career trajectory for the successful ones was that they would buy with their winnings, which were often, they'd often ship back £500,000 or £1 million, which is colossal fortunes in today's money. And they'd often just buy an estate, buy out an old gentry family that had fallen on hard times, be reviled locally for being the kind of nouveau riche, arrivistes, and appear as such in Jane Austen novels and in Thackeray and so on. And then buy themselves a rotten borough and get into Parliament. And by the 1780s, you have, I think, nearly a third of Parliament has returned East India Company employees, and probably the rest slave owners of some sort. So a right rogues gallery there. And so a lot of this stuff still remains in private hands, but obviously there's a lot also in public hands. One of the things I think that is a slight misconception is that the British did a massive art loot of India. The reality was that the Brits didn't like Indian art. They didn't like all those gods with arms and too many sort of erotic statues and this sort of thing. The Brits were busy looting places they didn't own, like sort of Athens when the Elgin Marbles come back at this point. But in general, there wasn't a taste for either Indian paintings or Indian sculpture in England. And actually, the British Museum collection, I don't know the portion, but a lot of the best stuff that's on display comes from one man called Hindu Stewart, who thought he was a Hindu. He married Hindu women, had his own team of Brahmins, and used actually to keep his statues in worship. So he's rather complicated categories. He doesn't quite count as a sort of art collector. He doesn't quite count as a looter, although I suppose he did loot these statues. But he would have regarded himself as a practicing Hindu, and he's someone that appears in my book, White Moogles, is a fascinating kind of character that adds complexity to this story.
William, as you've been discussing, you know, so much of your work shows how, you know, modern Britain is built on the spoils of empire. I'm really fascinated by the ways in which, you know, your own family history is implicated in
very
that
much
story.
Built on the spoils.
Yes,
of the family.
And I guess what that means for you as a human researching these histories, like how does your awareness of your own family history shape how you approach these stories? I mean, do you think of it as a kind of form of reparations or anything like that?
That would be to probably tell a fib, because the reality is I just love reading this stuff, and it just is the stuff that really, really interests me. So to be honest, no, even though I might occasionally be tempted to pitch it as a sort of form of reparation, like I have in a couple of interviews, I think the reality is that what fires me up is just that this is interesting. And to be honest, the fact that your ancestors have been involved in all this stuff adds to the fire of the thing. I had no idea when I first went to India that any of my family had really been there, other than I was vaguely aware that my dad had been there during partition as a young soldier. It turns out that typically for, I suppose, what you call my class in Scotland, which is minor gentry on the kind of margins of Scotland, these were exactly the people that were sent out to the colonies. Younger sons from posh but not very posh families would go out to try and keep their end up. They didn't have the lands to live like the dukes and the lords and the really grand aristocracy. And they always had aspirations greater than their resources. So the great thing was to send out one or two, or sometimes in the case of my wife's family, four or five each generation to try and pay the bills at home, frankly. All through Indian history, wherever I research, these Dharampals keep turning up. Some of them are war criminals. Some of them marry Indian women and have mixed families and are multilingual. One or two of them are extraordinary scholars who, one of them, James Prinsep, translates the Kharoshthi script and rediscovers the languages of ancient India and rediscovers Ashoka, the fact that the Buddha's from India, and really, you know, scores the scholarly jackpot and is now one of the very few Brits who is very well regarded still in India. But what I suppose it teaches you is we all want our ancestors to be heroic when we're growing up. We always assume that we're on the side of the angels. And the Brits of my generation grew up after the war, you know, being told that we had liberated the death camps, had defeated Hitler and the Nazis, and were the people that brought democracy and human rights to the world. And the fact that, you know, only 22 countries in the entire world have not been invaded by the Brits at some point in their history, and every 6 days, somewhere in the world, someone is celebrating independence from Britain. It's the most celebrated thing in the world that isn't a religious festival.
Well, not us. And I should note that we're recording this interview on the 11th of November, 50 years from the dismissal, which could be our Republican moment, but it wasn't and still isn't. But so there's a little historical synchronicity for you. So we did not do that in any 6 days or otherwise.
I think the point is, though, that you do, everyone wants that their ancestors to be heroes. And having direct experience of the fact that a lot of my ancestors, far from being heroes, were people that today would be probably sent off to The Hague if the ICJ was working properly, allows you, in a sense, once you've digested that, which took quite a lot of my 20s really to sort of, for the pennies to drop about this. Once you've digested that, you know, it allows you to look more critically at history and in general, the role of the West. And this is something that many people resist. You know, wherever you are in the world, people patriotically want their country to be regarded as on the side of the angels and fighting barbarism. And once you've digested that, you know, much as you might want that, it's often not the case. It allows you to look much more critically at the world.
And you're looking at the world critically through another lens now, but still interestingly using objects as archives to do that. Your next big project is a history of Palestine. And you wrote recently in an article in The Guardian, which I encourage people to read. I'm just going to read this little bit that you wrote. An exhibition of the salvaged antiquities of Gaza is currently showing at the Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, and it opens with a fabulous display of the distinctive torpedo jars in which the Gazans exported their wine. Tell us how jars can tell stories and the sort of story you expect to tell when the research for this book is complete.
So I had actually been reading the history of Gaza all summer. This has been my project since sort of, I suppose, April, a real deep dive into the history of Gaza. And it's, again, you know, a measure of how important the study of history is. We all have been watching what's happening in Gaza, the genocide and all the horrors associated with it. On the front pages of every newspaper of the world, lead headlines in every news bulletin for 2 years now. Not one single national broadcaster, not ABC here in Australia, not the BBC in Britain, not PBS in America, has ever tried to put on, or certainly has not so far broadcast, a history of Gaza or history of Palestine. So people have no idea of the history of this place. Gaza, it turns out, and I don't think I was probably aware of this before this summer, is one of the most ancient ports of the Eastern Mediterranean. The first references go back to the time, I think, of the Pharaoh Thutmose III in the 1480s BC. It was always regarded as a major center of wine production. Again, not something you'd expect when looking at the images of the kind of wasteland it has become today. And as late as the 6th century AD, these torpedo jars, which are very easy to spot archaeologically because they are literally shaped like a torpedo. They're these big, thick, long jars with a kind of little nipple at the bottom, which presumably you place it in wet earth to keep it upright. These are the mark of Garzen wine, which was a sweet wine. It was a pudding wine in our terms, the Chateau Chem of the ancient world, and highly regarded. The pharaohs, for much of the first millennium BCE, keep it as a royal monopoly. And this, what, you know, Tutankhamun would have been drinking as he sat in his riverboat floating up the Nile. It reaches as far as Anglo-Saxon England and Merovingian France in the 6th century. And this is only part of the very, very surprising history of Gaza. For example, Gaza is not also a place one would necessarily associate with erotic poetry, but in the 6th century AD, Gaza has an erotic literary festival dedicated to Dionysius, celebrated in spring and marking the onset of the rebirth of the landscape. Poets from around the Mediterranean came and recited erotic verses.
We should restore this practice. Too sweet. William, as you've been saying, there's been remarkably little public discussion about the very long history of Palestine and Gaza. Here in Australia and, you know, elsewhere in the world, there's been a lot of internal debate about to what extent historians and other academics and researchers should be speaking publicly about the genocide and condemning it. And there's, you know, very fraught politics around that. And one thing I really admire about your work is that you, you know, have been very freely talking about the genocide in your podcast and in your public appearances. What's your sense, I guess, of the role of the historian to, you know, be a political commentator?
I don't think the historian has any set role. You know, there are many different kinds of historians, whether it's historians of climate change, economic historians, historians of stamp collecting. You know, it's a vast field. And I don't think, you know, it's part of our job remit that we have to dive deep into activist politics or anything. And I think, you know, many great historians do not touch politics with a barge pole. However, if you are aware of the history of the Palestinians and are aware of how far their history has been actively suppressed by the Israeli state, and it has been said some Israeli historians, not all, and some are actually very bravely outspoken on the Palestinian side, but there is still out there this idea that Golda Meir first put out in the 1950s, that there is no such thing as the Palestinians, that it's a made-up identity. Anyone that writes about Palestine and gets into the Twitter sphere will find people claiming that the Palestinians don't exist or that they only arrived in the 7th century, which is something Netanyahu said last year. They are Arabs who sort of rode in on camels from Mecca in Islamic conquest, in his view. Others, again, there's a famous fraud called From Time Immemorial by I think Joan Peters in the 1970s that put out the idea that basically the Palestinians had arrived to build the kibbutzes in the 1920s and 1930s, and that they were very recent immigrants to a desert. Now, all this is actively suppressing and erasing what is unquestionable now from DNA evidence that the Palestinians, like the Jews, are descendants of the original inhabitants, and that the Palestinians and the Jews are cousins of each other, that they share many of the same haplop groups that you find in Bronze Age burials. If you look at the DNA and extract it, those are present in both the Israeli and the Palestinian population. There is so many attempts to deny the antiquity of the Palestinians' history. Many, as I say, regard the Palestinians as people that turned up as Arabs, in inverted commas. In reality, if you read the history and read the scholarship, it's very clear that the Palestinians contain the genes of what you'd find, of course, anywhere in the Mediterranean, which is a very mixed population with where different migrations and different invasions throughout history have brought many different people through the land. And the Palestinians have in their veins Canaanite, Jezebite, Moabite, Israelite, the tribes of Judah, Greeks, Persians, Byzantines, Romans, Crusaders, as well as the Arabs in their veins. And they are as with any Mediterranean coastal population, incredibly mixed. What happens is you have the population moving from basically being Hebrew and Aramaic speaking to becoming Greek speaking in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's conquest. Greek and Aramaic together remain the main languages there until about 150 years after the Islamic conquest, when Arabic begins to be widely used. As far as religious is concerned, a variety of pagan cults give way to the three Abrahamic religions, all of which flourish in Palestine. It's only as late as the 12th century that Palestine ceases to be majority Christian. And so what you get is this, you know, very slow change of faith, change of language, but it's basically the same people. There are migrations in and out, new peoples arrive, there are intermarriages, as in any other port in the Mediterranean. When the British turn up in 1917, when, thanks to an Aussie cavalry charge, the Third Battle of Gaza breaks the Ottoman lines, the British and their Indian and New Zealand and Australian imperial allies are facing the same troops that defeated them at Gallipoli under the same generals. There's three battles of Gaza in 1917, and finally the Aussies break it with this great heroic cavalry charge. A week after that, the Balfour Declaration is announced, and this country, which at that point is a 90% Christian and Muslim, is told that it will be the site of a Jewish homeland at a time when only 10% of the population is Jewish. And the Christians and the Muslims just referred to the non-Jewish inhabitants. And it's clear from subsequent correspondence that Balfour, who issued the declaration, had no idea about the proportion and population. And he assumed that there was, you know, it was at least 50, if not majority Jewish. Of course it wasn't. And later British inquiries, which is there in parliamentary white papers and so on, reveal the fact that the framers of this declaration had never been to Palestine, had no idea about its ethnic makeup. Now, of that 90% that were Christian and Muslim, 85% of them become refugees only 30 years later in 1948, when the Palestinians lose the battle for their homeland. And many of them end up as refugees on the sand dunes of Gaza, where they remain being shelled and subject to thermobaric bombs today.
William, thank you for telling us, particularly on Remembrance Day here, about the Battle of Gaza, which I have not heard about Anzacs fighting before. We absolutely romanticise our military history here and celebrate it, but that's not one that I've heard. I can't believe we have run out of time. Thank you for downloading even just a tiny part of your most expansive brain and your Herculean heart here for us. And, you know, thank you for your service in taking on that responsibility of the historian to make sure that that history is told and revived, and can't wait to see what you do with it. I'm imagining something like the Golden Road with what you did for the whole history of the civilization of India and its way it transformed the world with the Palestinian people in that part of the world. But that is all that we've got time for today. So thank you so much for joining us. To learn more about William's work, you can go to his website, williamdalrymple.com, or follow him on Instagram or on X, where he has 1.1 million followers. You can be one of those too.
You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees.
Don't forget, you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
I understood the power of the camera to reinforce identity, and in my case, in a very positive way. So here was a people who had been neglected, who had been denied, and I could bring up a camera and remind them how powerful they were, how beautiful they were in my eyes. And that's what you see in those images.